And if your water is not the right pH and you're trying to mix these water-soluble medications, it's you have a hard time. It ends up at the bottom of the pail and just a sludge, and it stops things up, and you got plugged nipples and everything else. And if you just had the pH of the water right, chances are that stuff would mix better and stay in solution.
It's time for a new era of communication in the swine industry. One that you can get the latest updates while commuting or driving to farms. Here you will have the brightest minds of the global swine industry in your pocket. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Anatox. Research shows that feed sanitizers reduce the onset of viruses in commercial swine feed. Improve swine productivity through powerful pathogen control with Anatox today. Digesterom Finish from DSM Firmenich can help your pigs finish faster. Get better efficiency with improved profitability with Digesterom Finish. MetaFarms, transforming agriculture with data-driven solutions for pork producers. Adiseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in a high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. SUNY, we provide value-added biotech solutions.
Hi, welcome to our latest edition of Swine It Podcast. I'm Jerry Purvis, your host. Today, we have a very special guest with us, Dr. James Kober. Dr. Kober is currently an independent consultant, and Dr. Kober, welcome to our podcast today.
Well, thanks for having me, Jerry. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Yep, and we'll just get started here. For some of the audience, maybe they are not familiar with you, but maybe take a few moments and just tell us a little bit about your career, your experiences, and how you got to where you are today.
All right, I'll do that. So I born and raised in West Michigan, right along Lake Michigan. There's a lot of orchards around. Grew up on a livestock and fruit farm. We had about 80 sows through the 70s and 80s, and we farrowed four litters a week. And we sold about a third of those pigs as feeder pigs and raised about two-thirds to market. And, you know, through the 70s and especially the 80s, there wasn't a whole lot of profit in pigs. But my dad made things work. I used to hear him and my mom talk about, you know, where the next feed bill was going to come from. But at the end of the day, we made a living, and he was able to keep up with modern equipment and so on. We did have about 40 acres of apples and cherries, and eventually we got out of those slowly. So we did chores in the morning and the evening, but we didn't sit in the barn all day with them because we had other things to do on the farm, our crops and our fruit. And it seems like at that time we had a sow that would kind of farrow on her own and raise her own pigs. And we got along quite well with that. I learned a lot of good husbandry from my dad and a couple of neighbors who had pigs. And maybe that's one thing that might be missing in the industry now, is just to sit down and understand the husbandry of raising these animals. But, so then I graduated from high school, went to Michigan State, earned a bachelor's degree in animal science, in the early 80s, and then went to veterinary school at Michigan State, graduated in 1987. My first job was in Cass County, Michigan, where they raised a lot of outdoor pigs back in the 70s and early 80s. And that county was the 14th largest producer of pigs in the country with all those outside pigs. But the beginning of the end with those is when they started paying for lean. In the early 90s, it turns out you just can't raise a really lean pig outside on the dirt, not like you can in confinement. I was there for 2 years. Then I went down to Central Indiana and practiced with Dr. Max Rodebaugh for about 5 years in a swine-only practice. Of course, that was all mostly confinement compared to outside pasture pigs. And then in 93, I came back to Michigan, and I kind of wanted to get back closer to home. And there was a need up here. There was a lot of good swine producers. and there wasn't a lot of good veterinary care. So I came and opened a practice in Holland, Michigan in 1993. And I practiced there until 2020. I sold that practice then to one of my partners. I was in a group called Four Star Veterinary Services. And that was some veterinarians from Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, solo practitioners that we just got together, and a lot of pigs from different areas ended up with us. And so it was kind of a group practice, but we had six different locations that we practiced out of. So that worked good. Once I sold my practice at the end of 2020, I sold it to one of those partners. And I've been doing independent consulting since then, primarily on water quality. I know in our PQA training, we talk about water flow and make sure there's enough water, but nobody really talks too much about the quality of the water and what that means. So I think in the swine industry, we're a little bit behind the poultry industry and perhaps the dairy industry on making sure that the water that these animals drink is high quality stuff. And, you know, people challenge me and say, you know, we used to have pigs that drank out of the pond, you know, and I said, yeah, but they didn't grow at 2 pounds a day. we've created a pretty high tech, pig here, big appetite, very efficient. And to try to raise that with poor quality water, it'll make it. And that's, you know, people say, well, what's the difference between bad water and good water? And I say, if you had poor quality water, an animal will drink just enough to get by. If you have good quality water, they're going to drink enough to thrive and grow and have big litters and breed back. So again, I think the swine industry is a little bit behind some of the other livestock industries on addressing the water quality issues. So that's a little bit about me and my career.
A worldwide leader in animal nutrition, Adiseo's portfolio of products includes methionine, the full range of vitamins, enzymes, organic selenium, probiotics, mycotoxin management strategies, and palatability products. With such a diverse offering, Adiseo supports its customers with a broad range of expertise, tools, and services to help them maintain a competitive advantage. Adiseo, fueling predictable profits. To learn more, visit Adiseo at www.adiseo.com.
Very good. Well, I have to ask you, when? Did you know early on working as a young boy that you want to be a vet, or was that something that came later as you got into animal science?
Well, I really wanted to be a airline pilot, but I was told in high school that's virtually impossible to get in without serving in the military, and I wasn't too hot on that, so I. My parents pushed me towards veterinary medicine. They knew I liked animals and liked, you know, my mom always wondered when I came to the kitchen when I was doing chores to get a knife, cause I had a dead pig I wanted to cut up. She reluctantly usually gave one, but I don't think it ever made it back to the kitchen, but, so they knew I liked fussing around with animals and so on. So they pushed me that way. Once I got, you know, I got my undergraduate degree, and once I get into vet school, a lot of people knew what they wanted to do. They were going to do small animal, or they were going to do equine, or they were going to do dairy, and this and that. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was just happy to be there. And then I, very early in veterinary school, Brad Thacker was, extension veterinarian at MSU at that time. And I saw him in the hall and talked to him and asked him a couple pig questions. And he said, and he asked me, do you have pig experience? And I said, yeah, I grew up on a pig farm. And he said, do you want a job? And I said, I guess I'll work. I hadn't thought about getting a job. I just want to pass. So I worked with Brad all the way through veterinary school. And I probably skipped too many classes to go with him on his herd visits. But boy, looking back, that was so valuable. I don't know if the students can get away with missing a day a week going to farms like I did, but he taught me a lot. He's certainly one of my mentors that I look up to and talk to regularly, even to this day, and learned a lot through him. But anyway, so I got, I didn't get into vet school knowing I wanted to do swine, but everybody knew I grew up on a pig farm. So anytime there was a pig question with a classmate, they automatically came to me. So I kind of got funneled into the pigs, and then working with Brad, got into the industry, started coming to the AASV meetings and so on. So I would say it happened by default. I didn't necessarily have that in mind when I started veterinary school.
Yeah. Well, I guess we have some commonality a little bit. I started as I worked in a family business, swine operation. And I also wanted to be a fighter jet pilot. And so, but I saw in there you had, when I found out you had to see 2020, that pretty much ended that. we had some commonality there, but very good. So you've got a lot of experiences, you know, prior to even, you know, to growing up. And I think that makes a big difference when you can relate to problems and issues when you've been there and been on the farm side of it. So, well, you know, you talked about water quality. So maybe I got a few topics I want to get your thoughts on, your expertise. But, you know, taking water quality, we know, you know, a pig's going to eat drink twice the amount of water for weight that he's going to eat. So very important there. But what have you seen as you go around and you look at people, you know, when you start looking at water quality?
Well, unfortunately, there's not a lot of good research, side-by-side research with treated water versus untreated water. So I pushed some of the quality companies like Neogen and Best Vet to get some data out there, because farmers aren't going to install these systems if they don't have data. So I really push them to get more data. But first of all, if the water tastes better, obviously you're going to drink. And the other thing that people don't realize is from a medication standpoint, a lot of the water-soluble medications mix and become soluble at a specific pH. And if your water is not the right pH and you're trying to mix these water-soluble medications, you have a hard time. It ends up at the bottom of the pail and just a sludge, and it stops things up, and you got plugged nipples and everything else. And if you just had the pH of the water right, chances are that stuff would mix better and stay in solution. So that's the main thing, is both taste and functionality of getting your medicine to the pigs. If you're paying all that money for the medicine, why wouldn't you want to use it right?
Yeah, I mean, I think to your point, we're probably behind the poultry. I know poultry they monitor consumption, water consumption, you know, daily and hourly. So with these new controllers, and I think swine are starting to catch up a little bit, but I think it's also a good area where, you know, we see that water consumption go down. Maybe we get ahead of a disease prevention. Start figuring out something's wrong. But very good point, you know, about we've all done that, you know, mixed up that bucket and got that medicator going, and we looked down at the bottom when we're done, and all this medicine's down at the bottom. We didn't even get it to the pigs.
So when I go on to a farm, I approach a couple different things. First, you know, you need to do a water test, and you need to have a good lab and a consistent lab that understands livestock. You can't send it to a human lab because they don't understand what's necessary for the livestock. But we figure out the pH. A lot of water here in the Midwest has a lot of iron in it, and that iron will bind up some of those medicines as well. So we, you know, some farms we need to get a big iron filter and filter that iron out of there. Sometimes we have other things in there, and sometimes, you know, through the testing, about 10% of the nursery water I test has E. coli in it, right in the water from the well. And,
wow.
So if you can't get on top of a scour problem, maybe it's because you're actually seeding those pigs down every time they drink. So people are always shocked to see that. So that, you know, if nothing else, you can figure out your iron, your pH, and if you have coliforms in your water. If you solve those things, then 90% of the time you're golden. Every once in a while, you'll come across a farm that has high sulfur or high nitrates or something like that, but that's fairly unusual.
Yeah.
So you test, you figure out what you got, and then, you know, even before, if you want to put a treatment system in, acidifier and whatnot, it helps a lot just to clean the lines. If you have a good line cleaner, twice a year when the barn's empty, or maybe the sow barn's never empty, but you could put some things in there to clean the lines. And a lot of times that's just enough on water quality, is just to keep your lines clean and don't let that biofilm build up.
What do you think? I know this is a hard question to answer, but where you've seen issues with water, and then you go in and maybe you work with them and they fix those issues. What do you think? What have you seen as far as growth, performance, mortality? You've seen, what are some of the maybe after you've gone in and maybe improved that water quality?
Well, I'm going to tell you about a dairy example rather than pigs, because sometimes a pig guys don't have good enough records to pick up slight improvements. But more than one dairy farm has told me after we put a system in and get the water straightened around, say, gosh, my water consumption went up 6 pounds per cow and my milk production went up 2 pounds per cow. Wow. And they can measure that even in large dairies. They know exactly what everybody's eating and everybody's drinking. And then he said the side note is, you know, I used to have to send my employees out and wash the drinking troughs two or three times a week because it would get this black scummy buildup in it. And he said, since we're treating the water, that doesn't happen anymore. We don't have to clean those troughs at all anymore. So that's just some experiences from the dairy side.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people don't realize that on a per kilogram basis, a sow is probably a greater milk producer when you look at it on a body weight. So a lot of water. Got a sow that's farrowing and milking, is their water consumption has got to be huge.
Yep.
So
first thing you look at if you got a sow that's not eating is making sure she's got good water.
That's right. Yeah. They're not going to eat, they're not drinking. And if they're not drinking, they're not eating, they're not milking. So, yeah. You know, a guy told me one time, and I guess it makes a lot of sense. If you get feeding water correct, you're well on your way to having good production.
Yeah.
Throwing hay. So, but yeah, I think to your point, a lot of times we do not look at water and give it the due that it needs attention. Changing a little past a little bit, taking last year, and it seemed like last year was maybe a little better health that we had, you know, and but looking at in 2024, as we get in here to early start, what are some of the things, challenges, and how would you compare the health going into this year, what you've seen in the area?
It's a great question. In Michigan, our pigs have kind of become strung out, so to speak. So some of the large producers have gone north and bought land way up north out of the pig dense areas. And even our pig dense areas is nothing like Iowa or southern Minnesota or something like that. But so we have, I would say, well over half of our production in Michigan has never seen PRRS, and that's a huge advantage for these guys. But, you know, they're an hour north, an hour and a half north of Grand Rapids, so they have to truck all their inputs up there and truck the pigs back. So there's a cost to that, but there's certainly a health advantage to being off in the woods, so to speak,
right,
compared to the dense areas. One thing I've seen in the last couple of years is more guys are buying their replacement gilts rather than try to raise them, because if they're raising them and they break with PERS, you know, they can't just dump all that and start over. They've got too much money into it. So they kind of have to use those PERS positive animals. The advantage to buying them is they can get them in. If they choose to expose them or choose to vaccinate them for PERS, they can do that on a herd level and get everybody at the same plane. So that's helped a lot, stabilize the sow herds by bringing a stable gilt in, obviously. So, and the viral things, we haven't seen too much flu in Michigan. I think that's because, you know, we're so spread out. Again, disadvantage to being spread out is more cost for transportation and so on. But health-wise, it's golden. The thing I really try to help producers with is the low-grade bacterial stuff that I don't think really in the industry gets addressed enough. And by that, I mean, if you see these pigs at the end of a finisher turn and they have kind of runny eyes and they're the ones that have a lot of bacterial crap in. You can get strep suis and parasuis and A suis and Mycoplasma hyorhinus, any or all of those out of pigs. And I think sometimes the bacterial load is there. You know, we're trying to be smart with our antibiotic usage. So maybe we're using less antibiotics than we used to. So those bacterial things are getting a foothold again. We had pretty good control of them in the past, but that's a concern of mine. And you know, a lot of the genetic companies have gotten away from doing slaughter checks anymore. But I think, and I've seen, if you have a pig with those runny eyes at the end of a finisher stage, he's going to have some turbinate atrophy, and I've looked hard for toxigenic type D Pasteurella, and I can't find any of that. So there's something else in that bacterial mix that's causing some turbinate atrophy in some of these pigs. And I honestly think the genetic companies need to get back to doing slaughter checks. I know it's costly and logistically it's a nightmare with the big slaughter plants anymore, but I encourage my smaller producers, you know, any finisher pig that dies, you know, cut the snout on it, and you don't have to grade it. You know, I show them where to cut it and just save them in a bag in the fridge. And the next time I'm there, I'll look at them and we'll see if you have turbinate atrophy. And if you do, we can do something about it, or we can try to do something about it. But I think there's a little bit more of that low grade bacterial stuff going on than people care to talk about. And I actually just read an article this morning and asked the question, you know, we have these really elaborate and helpful classification systems for PERS and now for flu. I think we need to develop one of those classification systems for those low-grade bacterial things, the strep suis, the parasuis. So when two vets or two producers are talking, they can say, well, I have this much strep suis and I have this much parasuis. Rather than say, yeah, well, you know, we have to medicate once in a while, that's pretty vague. But I really think the low-grade bacterial stuff is something that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, it seems like PERS gets the big headlines and worrying about ASF, and you know, we're trying to figure out how we're going to prevent, or what we're going to do if we get ASF. But those bacterial things, they nickel and dime us to death, I think, sometimes, and we don't realize the impact that immune system being activated and dealing with is costing us as an industry. But I agree 100%. There probably should be some more interest there. And it seems like we see more things pop up here lately. You know, as you get cleaner sometimes, you know, then you get these other things that maybe you hadn't seen in a while, and you'll start seeing them.
Yeah, and I don't know if the breeding company are doing much to address that. They're creating a lean pig and a fast growing pig and a big appetite pig, but sometimes they forget about the bad things they're creating with that, and you know, oftentimes don't want to admit there's any problems. But you know, and maybe the prolapse in the sow and the robustness of the finisher pig, that kind of got left out of the index they're using for a long time, and I hopefully it's back in their index now. But so that's a bad trait that they forgot to screen for.
Yeah, no doubt. As they started selecting for these higher lean and now sows that are more prolific, we've lost some areas. We've lost some ground in some very important areas that I think we don't think about. Just on sows, you know, mothering ability sometimes, you know, that's part of maybe we're at our pre-weaning mortality. We have pig sows that really are selected for high litter size, but then maybe not as good of, you know, mothering techniques. We've kind of mixed that a little bit. So, but, you know, very good. You see, you mentioned just going on a little about we talked earlier a little bit about biosecurity, and what do you think has changed? What are some of the things we've learned here currently that maybe give us room to pause a little bit about our biosecurity plans, or some areas we need to work on, and where people fail a lot of times?
Oh, that's a good question. I think the farms I deal with, I'm pretty happy with the biosecurity, although it seems like there is always a handful of farms that just don't even think about it. And sometimes they get along okay, and sometimes they don't. You know, when I had the veterinary practice, I still had guys that came in their chore boots and, you know, don't bother changing boots on the way out of the barn and drive to town with the dirty boots. And, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, that was pretty common, but it's pretty uncommon now, but still happens. You know, the shower thing, maybe that's overdone. I think, in the big picture, I think changing clothes and using a Danish entry can achieve almost as much as shower, and especially when people aren't around other pigs, when they're not around the farm.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody's never around a pig, there's really not much to shower off, so to speak. But I guess better safe than sorry. It's not hurting anything by showering. It's just taking some time. And the ASF biosecurity, I think I'm worried that we've been doing secure pork supply and plans for farms and doing all the diagramming and the people flow and the traffic flow and everything. And I'm thinking I'm seeing some biosecurity fatigue, and nothing's happened with ASF for 5 years. So guys are saying, well, I don't think we need to do this anymore. I don't think we need to do this anymore. So I'm a little nervous that some producers are backing off on the stringent biosecurity, especially when nobody's looking.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. I remember, 2014 when we had the big PED and everybody really got serious about biosecurity, and we were able to really make some inroads and prevent spreading. But as we got, you know, away from that and you got farther away, it seemed like everybody kind of relaxed. And I think during PED, we saw less PERS. You know, we people were doing things that were helping on a lot of fronts with a lot of health challenges. So, yeah, I think that's a real risk, is people get complacent, you know, with the.
I think probably the biggest biosecurity thing now is just market truck. I don't think in a lot of systems they get washed often enough or at all. And I I have a feeling that I don't deal with any chronic PED herds here in Michigan, but I have a feeling maybe some of the chronic PED sites and systems in the industry just aren't paying enough attention to market trucks or taking the time to clean them. And I know that's a cost, but so is PED. So
that's right.
Where do you draw the line there?
Let me ask you, Jim. So what do you think are some practices that we do that probably are not helping us very much, maybe hurting us? What are some things that we should be doing that most people don't address in their plans? Because it costs money to do a lot of these things, you know, and time, like you said.
Yeah. So we haven't really tested, you know, what's, you know, during the pandemic, we had some issues where some finisher pigs needed to be euthanized because there was no place to go with them. And that, I think, gave us some really good information, not happy information, but good information on how we're going to actually handle large numbers of euthanasias if we need to do that for a disease. I think there's a lot of good research going on now on how to depopulate a herd. I don't know if we're still there on how we're going to dispose of these large number of animals, but I think we're getting a handle on how we're going to euthanize them. Having said that, that was not done in the face where USDA's there, having set up a truck wash, set up boot baths, you know, running around in Tyvek suits. So that hasn't been tested yet. You know, the Red Book tells us, you know, we're going to have a truck wash set up at the end of every driveway if ASF comes up. But to actually get that done, I think we've done some exercises, but I'm not sure we've practiced adequately on that. So that's a concern of mine, that if we ever do need to put those things in place, that we're going to be able to do that in a timely manner. I mentioned earlier, especially on finisher sites, I'm not sure if showering in every day is necessary. I think changing clothes and boots obviously is absolutely necessary. But you go to a lot of finisher sites, if they're multiple barn sites, you know, a lot of guys will change boots on the way into barn number one and then tromp between the barns. So I don't know that we've saved anything there.
Yeah.
So even changing boots on every barn when you're going between, or maybe you could build hallways between the barns so you don't have to go outside. I've done that on a couple farms too, with good success.
So I guess you're saying more or less if that person that walks in that barn, if we could control that they've got clean boots, that hadn't been around other pigs, that stay on that facility, and then changing clothes, that's two of the key things that we need to do with our plans.
Yep. And then you know, a lot of the disease breaks you still see, it's because the pigs came in with something, and so making sure the pigs are at the health status you expect them to be at. You know, you can have filters and showers and great biosecurity, but if a pig walks in carrying a virus, then it's all for naught. So.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, I think the pigs, that's where most of it, a lot of times, the highest risk is that pig bringing in. Or as you said, you know, anytime you introduce a gilt to a herd, you know, that's always a risk. What about these wash stations you see at some farms for trucks and coming in and out? Is that something you think is really beneficial or more of a risk?
Well, I suppose it depends on the situation, but when you've got clean water and clean disinfectant, they're probably very useful. But as the day wears on and you get multiple trucks through there and the water gets pretty dirty, then towards the end of the day, you're wondering if you're doing anything other than creating a mess. So it's just like anything else with biosecurity, you got to keep on top of it and keep the water fresh, keep the disinfectant fresh. It's not something you can just do once a day in the morning and expect it to last all day.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, so, well, that's a good tips there. I think everybody has some room to improve their biosecurity, and if everybody made a little bit of improvement, we probably would make some great strides in that area. We talked a little bit about least cost versus best cost. Maybe talk a little bit what you're talking about there as far as nutrition.
Yeah, nutrition, you know, we have nutritionists on staff and we get a balanced diet. But I wonder sometimes if those diets are balanced to the average pig. And if they're balanced towards the average pig, then there's 50% of the pigs that aren't getting enough of the proper nutrients, and the other 50% are getting a little more. So I wonder if you should be balancing diet for the bottom end instead of the average. That's one thing. And the other thing, just a specific example in Michigan, is our soil is woefully deficient in selenium. So we deal with mulberry heart disease in wean pigs every day. And if your nutritionist is not in the state and doesn't understand that, then he still will not address that nutritionally. And we can inject with BOCE or MUCE and get those pigs going pretty good. But it sure would be a lot easier to take care of that in the feed if we could. So that's an example where we're so concerned about the cost of the diet that we don't want to actually make it right. So that's just one example here that I deal with in Michigan.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You know, sometimes, and I think it's been, it's really, you see a lot of it when you have commodity, you know, markets like we've been facing the last couple of years, where corn is and meal is really high. And everybody's looking for somewhere to cut. And it seems we try to cut, you know, maybe things that we can't afford to be wrong about that are just a small, you mentioned trace minerals. I think there's areas, vitamins, trace minerals, there's a lot of areas where maybe we're teetering on the edge, and it's just a few cents when you look at the, you know, the cost of that, that pig's diet. So sometimes we're penny wise and pound foolish. Sometimes.
Yeah, and that's a good analogy of teetering on the edge, because I use that sometimes with farmers and said, you know, your diet is correct. There's just some pigs that are falling off the wrong edge.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, we're feeding to the pigs that but we're not feeding to maybe half of them or the bottom part of them.
Yeah, we're feeding for an average intake and not a low intake pig.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, good point. I think particularly I think with gilts development, sometimes we try to, you know, feed them like we do finishers, and when we should be feeding more down to the bottom, you know, making sure that all those gilts are getting exactly what they need.
Yeah, that is a great point. I was thinking about that the other day, that this one large system here in Michigan, they feed their gilts finisher diets until they take them out of the barn at 280 pounds. And it seems to me that it would be a better gilt if they had a gilt diet and took 7 months to get them to 280 instead of 5.5 months.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, definitely a lot of room there. Again, it's looking at, you know, now you're trying to raise an animal that you hope to keep, that you're going to get at least 3 litters off, you know, at a minimum. Different than pig, you're going to send to market at 280 pounds.
Yeah, I have a little problem. I don't want to change the subject too much, but if you're out and buying gilts from a genetic company and only expect to get 3 litters out of them, then you're probably paying too much.
Yeah.
That's been a frustration of mine for years, is, you know, as much as producers pay for a replacement gilt, surely you should create a gilt that can get more than 3 litters. And that's a big shortcoming of the industry, is that we put up with replacement gilts that only last 2, 3, maybe 4 litters, and then we're replacing them already.
Do you think that's genetic? Maybe, as you mentioned, nutrition or management or some of all above? Why we don't have longevity with these, we're not seeing with these animals?
Yeah, well, the longevity thing has been going on for a long time. As long as I could remember on Pig Champ or whatever program you look at, the average parity on sows is around 3.5. And that certainly hasn't gone up over the years. If anything, it's gone down. And it just seems to me that, longevity is one of the things they forgot to select for.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It's been very replacement, being able to impact mortality. I think a lot of chances we don't really understand why these animals are leaving. 40%, what is it? 40% of our mortality, sow mortality, we have no idea really what caused that. So there's a lot of room for us to learn and try to get out in front and understand why are these animals leaving the herd, for sure.
I hired a student one year in a large system, a 10,000 sow system, and I had her do a necropsy on every single pig that died post weaning, and we learned so much from that. She did hundreds of pigs through the summer, and I wish I had the money to pay a student to post every sow that dies, but that might be more than a one person job.
but you're right. Until we figure out the causes, it's kind of hard to figure out the prevention and figure out. You mentioned prolapses. We really haven't figured that out yet. But it's going to take some work doing what you're saying. We got to get digging there and really find out what's going on and why these animals are, falling out of the herd. So very good.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. AB Vista, new nutritional perspectives and novel enzyme applications to drive pig production. Healthy Farms by Bioverse, your manure management experts. FeedFlow, feed is too expensive to ignore. Take control with FeedFlow. AccuFast, the best way to predict the future is to create it. Start creating your future today at AccuFastSwine.com. Eastman works with you to accelerate your nutritional program innovation. Meet AccuFast, your trusted partner in raising efficient, healthy, and sustainable pork. We're not just about genetics, we're about tailored solutions that set you on your path to success, no matter how you define it. At AccuFast, we channel our investments into three crucial pillars: our genetic offering, proprietary technology platform, and leading commercial measurement system, ensuring tangible results for our partners. Visit our website at AccuFastSwine.com or reach out to an AccuFast customer success rep to discuss how we can help you create the future you've been working towards. AccuFast, the best way to predict the future is to create it.
Well, Jim, we're getting close to the end of our time here, but we always want to ask three questions of our guests. And the first question is, what would you say is your favorite swine resource?
Well, I still go back to Diseases of Swine. Awesome book. Gets redone regularly. If you want the Cliff Notes version, then there's a swine disease manual from AASV. It has just a one-page synopsis of every disease instead of a whole chapter. So those two things. And that swine disease manual is good, that I'm comfortable leaving that with producers so they have that on their shelf so they can have a quick read when I say, oh, there's strep suis here or there's A suis there. They can grab that and read a half a page or a page on that and get a pretty good understanding of what's going on there. So I still do that. Of course, on the internet, the pig site is a great resource. AASV, they have all the articles and from all the journals that you can have access. So that's a great site to go to as well.
Very good. The internet, it's amazing now, which you can Google and find out whatever you want to know about something. It's always, I think that's helped, helped us in a lot of ways, finding answers to things. But yeah, good point. I think that's important. Producers have a resource there that they can look at it and understand it when you say, you know, have a diagnosis, that they're understanding what they're facing. Second question, and I know this is a tough question to narrow it down, but who would you say would be your most influential person who impacted your career?
Well, I think everybody's probably going to say one of their parents, and that would be the case with me. When I was growing up, my dad taught me, you know, the husbandry, you know, how to take care of pigs, how to watch pigs, how to understand what they're doing, and, you know, let them tell you what they need, kind of things, you know, and sometimes that meant, you know, sitting on a 5-gallon bucket and just watching them. So that would be number one. And then the big mentors I had, through my veterinary career, Dr. Gary Fedor was my first boss. He was not a pig guy, but he was a great veterinarian. He taught me a tremendous amount just on client communication and how to treat clients and you know, how to treat animals as well. But the big thing on him was, you know, how to treat people, how to treat clients, how to answer the phone and how to talk on the phone and what to say and what not to say. And then, of course, Max Rotabaugh, when I worked for him, you're not going to find anybody better than him. And I miss him dearly, miss him every day. And then I mentioned Brad Thacker when I was going through school. I certainly would not be where I'm at today without Brad's guidance through vet school, or maybe it was misguidance, but man, he taught me a lot of stuff.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. Very interesting. It's a lot of people in it, and we take different things from different people that come into our lives. And, you know, we don't get all of it from one person. We take the good and the things from different people, and they, you know, they stay with us. So I think that's a good point. It's not always one person. We're a sum of a lot of, you know, people over our career. So very good. And lastly, I would just say in the vet space, what do you think are some of the important characteristics that a good vet, you know, has to have, and what characteristics make a good vet?
One thing I tell the students that ride with me is listen, just listen to what the client has to say. Observe, you know, with all your senses, you know, you can hear, you can smell, you can see if, you know, through your smell, you can tell if the environment's bad or if it's good. I don't know so much about taste, but I have been known to taste pig feed once in a while to see if it's sour or not. But use all your senses. And the big thing is just listen. You cannot learn anything if you're talking. So listen and try to learn some things.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, we should hear more than we talk. We got two ears, so and one mouth, so we're designed. We should hear twice as much as we talk. But it's a very good point. But you know, and also you made a good point about if we observe, the pigs will tell us the problem, and will tell us what they need. If we're just there to observe and to read them.
Yep, I have employees at my finisher barn. You know, ears when the pigs are newly weaned, and they'll ask, "Well, how do we know if the brooders are too warm?" And I said, "Just look at the pigs. I said, if they're laying under the brooder, we're good. If they're not laying under the brooder, then we need to make it a little less hot. If they're all piled up where the brooder should be, then they're too cold. But they'll tell us if they're too warm or too cold."
Exactly. Yep. That's it's all real simple. Sometimes, you know, the solution to problems, we want to make them complicated, but when you watch the pigs, they'll tell you what's wrong. So true. That's so true. Yep. Jim, I appreciate your time today, and thank you for all your tidbits and, you know, on a lot of different areas. I love talking to people with a lot of experience. I learn something every time, and so you're never too old, I think, to learn. But I always enjoy talking to people with you've got what, about 50 years in the industry, maybe?
We started Farrowin in 1971. So yeah, we had three farrowing crates in the basement of a bank barn and farrowed there for a couple of years. So yeah, that was 1971.
Yeah, so you've seen a lot of pigs in your career over the span of your career. So
yep.
Very good. Well, very good. Well, appreciate you being on our podcast today, and good luck to you in your consulting.
All right, very good, and hopefully we'll cross paths in the future.
I hope so.
Looking to elevate your brand and captivate audiences through the power of podcasting? Look no further. Introducing the custom podcast brought to you by Wisemetics, where we take care of the behind the scenes so that you can focus on what truly matters. Podcasting has become an invaluable tool for brand awareness, but let's face it, putting it into practice can be a daunting task. It's incredibly time-consuming and requires technical know-how. But don't worry, we've got you covered. With our experienced team at the helm, we'll handle the operational aspects so you can channel your energy into what your company does best. Are you ready to unleash the podcasting potential of your company? Schedule a call with one of our specialists today at the link in the bottom of this episode. You'll also receive a free podcast strategy consult tailored to the unique needs and goals of your business.